welcome everybody to the special Easter Sunday podcast for Rouse Hill Baptist Church. And our special guest this morning is Sylvia Collinson. So Sylvia, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Rick. Yeah, good to be here.
So maybe to start with, would you like to tell us where you were born and about your family of origin?
Right. Well, I was born in Burwood. I'm the second child. My parents were Christians, and so they married, met in a church group, married. I had three children, and so I've got an older brother and a younger sister. My father was older than my mother, so he had a good job. And so he had been involved in electrical trades and became a TAFE teacher of electrical trades in the TAFE system. So we always got lots of good holidays, which was wonderful as a family.
Okay. It's interesting the connection between having a trade and teaching as well. And some people I've discovered in life love that combination of being able to teach as well as being involved in their trade.
Yes, that's right. I think he enjoyed that.
So where did you go to school?
Well, I started school in Burwood. In Enfield, actually. I was there for a term.
Yeah.
Then my parents were worried about my brother and I crossing Liverpool Road at that stage. So we transferred over to Burwood Primary School. And as a little seven-year-old and five-year-old, we walked to school because my mum had a new baby. And we were there for, I was there for about another term. And then my father got a move in his job to Newcastle. So we went to Newcastle and we stayed there for 5 years. And I went to Katara Primary School, which was just a little three-teacher school.
So in these days today when most kids get driven to school, maybe we don't realise that most people used to just walk to school. How far did you walk to school?
Well, it would be the I'm not too certain about the Enfield one because I haven't done it since I was a child. But to Burwood, it was probably over a kilometre.
Yeah, every day.
Yeah, every day. I wouldn't have thought it was particularly safe these days, but we did. Yeah.
So what did you do after you finished school?
Well, that only got me to primary school.
Yeah.
Then I went 2 more years of primary school at Eastwood. We moved back to Sydney, and then I went to Cheltenham Girls High School. So that was my schooling. After school, I went to Sydney Teachers College and became a primary school teacher.
And where did you teach?
I started off at Stanmore Primary and was there for 4 years. Then I got a country appointment to Boambi, which was a three-teacher school just south of Coffs Harbour, and that was heaven. It was just beautiful. A lot of banana-growing plantation children who were very uncivilized almost. It was just a lovely, homely kind of school. And then I came back to Sydney and taught for a year back at Stanmore. And then I went to England and did some supply teaching in London.
So what was it like leaving heaven to go back to Sydney?
Well, Stanmore wasn't an easy school because it had a very high percentage of recent immigrants. I remember one time I was on playground duty and there was an enormous fight in the playground between the older Italian and Greek boys, and I walked into the middle of this with a whistle and calmed them all down and sent them all off to the principal's office. It was different.
Challenging.
Challenging, that's right.
By the way, do you like kids?
Yes, yes. I loved my teaching time, although I had a few very difficult years.
Okay. So why did you go to London?
Well, I was in my late 20s. Most of my friends either married or went overseas, so I did the latter. Travelled around Europe in a van, as everybody did in those days, with a group of others. And then I thought it didn't look like I was going to be married and have a family. So I thought, well, what else would I like to do with my life? And I decided that more than anything, I'd like to teach the Bible. So I thought, well, I'll have to go and do some training. So I went to London School of Theology and did a 3-year degree there.
Okay. So this story is going to have quite a change to it, because here is Sylvia, the single woman, convinced she's going to be single, going to Bible college, and to then find later on that life is going to change quite radically, as it often does for many of us. So amongst all this mixture of this expectation of being a single woman overseas and studying the Bible to do some kind of education in that area, so where did you come to a place of wanting to do that? What was your spiritual journey?
Yeah, that's a good thing to reflect on. As a child, my parents were very, they themselves had a very strong personal relationship with Jesus, with God, and we just grew into that as a family, as children. Both of my parents taught Sunday school, took us to church, so it was very much a part of our life. When I was 8, we had a special mission, it was called, at our church, and they asked people if they wanted to give their lives to God. And that seemed to me to be something that I really wanted to do. So when we came, my brother did the same too, and lots of Sunday school kids. When we came home and told Mum, she said, "Well, if you're Christians, you should be reading the Bible." So she purchased for us some Scripture Union Bible reading aids. And so from the age of 8 till actually now, I have made that a part of my daily life as much as it's been possible, and that's just being in contact with God, reading His Word, listening to it and trying to put that as part of my life, and praying to Him. So I think that practice actually took me through my teenage years, which weren't easy. During that time I didn't have a good relationship with my father, and I think when I was at school, I was the little goody-goody who was leader of the ICF and did things like that, but I was rather difficult to live with at home. And I just think the family were patient with me, God was patient with me, and I remember a real turning point when I was about 19, when I realised that I needed to get my relationship with my father restored, and we did, and that was a real blessing. So so following God, and also because I tend to be a reasonably an active kind of person, I started teaching Sunday school. I was a girls' brigade leader. I went on CSSM beach missions. I was involved in inter-school Christian fellowship at school and camps and youth group and all that kind of thing. So it was very much a part of my life to be involved and active.
And Scripture Union was a major part of your life throughout your life. Tell us, if you'd like to, how did your relationship with your father get on later on?
Well, when we had this great big blow up, I hadn't been talking to him for weeks and everything. My father came into where I was, and he was really upset, and I don't think I ever saw my father cry before. Mm. And that had an enormous impact on me, because I think I felt that he didn't love me as a teenager, and I think in a way was kind of scared of having a teenage daughter now. Yep. When I look back.
Many fathers have been.
And also I think I'd been his favourite as a child, so it turned around quite dramatically when I became a teenager. And after that, I think I can remember Mum saying to me, well, he's your father. And I think as I grew older, I came to understand he'd had a difficult upbringing. His father had been killed 6 months before he was born. And there were a whole lot of things that made him the person he was. And I just had to accept that and love him for that.
It's interesting you say that what impacted you was his tears.
Yeah.
And so often when we see someone's true emotions, it just changes our perspective about them.
It does, yeah. And that still touches me even now.
Yeah, I believe that. Yeah. And you're not the only person who's seen parents when they reveal their true emotion and what it means for them.
Yeah. That's right.
So Sylvia, the single woman, planning to be involved in some kind of Bible education. She's doing her Bachelor of Arts at the London School of Theology. And then you didn't stay there. What happened next?
Well, I thought I'm a woman and there's no opportunities for women to do much in teaching, so I'd better be a missionary. So this is while I was still in London. I wrote to three different mission societies and said I was interested in some Bible teaching somewhere in the world and I was just available. And each one of them wrote back and said, go back to Australia, settle into your church, and then contact us again in about 3 years' time. So I was devastated, but I could see what they, of course, they were faith missions where you needed to have support, and I'd been a single in the singles life in London with very little sort of long-time stability there. So I thought, oh dear, what am I going to do now? And my home church contacted me and said, we're looking for a women's and children's worker. We'd like you to consider it. And because I'd been very much into the singles life, and this was a young area with a lot of young families and non-working mothers, I thought my lifestyle is so different from these people. I'm not going to have a real ministry to them because I don't identify particularly with them. So I wrote back and I said, thank you for asking me. That was, you know, very kind, but really it's not me. And I'll just be praying that you'll find the right person. And then I thought, phew, that's good. I got out of that one. And then the pastor contacted me sometime later. Oh, I have to say, we used to have these regular prayer days and I was coming to the end of my degree and I thought, God, what do you want me to do if the mission area is closed up and everything else? So I said to him, look, I'll do whatever you want me to do. And that afternoon, the post used to come in the morning and afternoon at that stage in England. I got the afternoon post and here was a letter back from the pastor saying, we'd still like you to come, but you can work out your own job description.
Your own job description?
Yes, yes.
What did you say to that?
Well, then God and I had a fight for 3 months because I really didn't want to go back there. And it was the story of Moses at the burning bush that kept on throwing God excuses and God kept on answering them that finally wore me down and I realized that if you belong to God, you have to do what he wants you sometimes when you don't even want to.
So you came back?
So I came back and the pastor said to me, just look at everything that's happening in the church, see where you think you might be involved and come back and tell us. So I did.
Wow. And did the pastor accept what you finally wanted to do?
Yes, he was very happy.
Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gee, oh, for bosses like that.
He was a very good boss. Yeah.
And you went on to do a number of things. You became involved in education, in Christian education. You did a Master of Education from Sydney University. You did a PhD from Murdoch, so you're Dr. Sylvia Collinson. It's very impressive, Sylvia.
I don't say that very often.
And you've been involved in teaching at Bible colleges, theological colleges. You were the vice principal of a theological college. Where was that?
Well, after I'd been at the church for 4.5 years, I heard it was about fifth hand about a job that was going in South Australia in a Bible college. And all these there were other women who had theological education about the same age as me. They had all decided for various reasons they didn't want to move to South Australia. And for me, my passion to teach the Bible was so much I would have gone anywhere. So, and when I told the pastor what had happened, he said, "You've heard, this is amazing. You've even heard about this job," because I didn't ever see it advertised. It was just word of mouth. So I had an interview and was appointed there. The college was going through a big change. This is in Adelaide. It had just moved from beautiful Victor Harbour, where lots of students, I think, went to Bible college because they could go surfing as well. And it was a lovely holiday place. When it moved up to Adelaide, the whole student body changed, and there were a lot more part-time people who lived in the city. And so I went there. But in this change, there was a big turnover at staff as well. And I ended up with just on the full-time staff, just the principal and myself. So it was a pretty heavy load to get landed with immediately. But I was there for 15 years and had worked with three different principals and just enjoyed a smaller college, but one where there was a very strong community and where there was a faithfulness to teaching the Bible. So I was able to teach gradually subjects that were my choice.
And you met Gavin. Tell us about Gavin.
Right. Well, I actually met Gavin within a matter of weeks of arriving in Adelaide, because the principal of the college said to me, "Where are you going to go to church?" And I said, "Oh, I don't know." So I tried out 10 different churches in Adelaide, and the principal said to me, "Just go down and have a look at this particular church, Morfitt Vale Baptist, because the pastor there has just applied for a job with us." So I went down there, and Gavin was, hadn't ever met him or anything, but I met him at the door as I was going out.
So this was
out.
Not across the crowded room. This was at the door.
That's right, yes. And he came, and we worked together for a number of years, and then he moved on and moved to Western Australia. In that time, his marriage broke down, and although it was very painful for him, around that time I was given a sabbatical and wanted to do something in that combined education and theology. And the only way I could do that was to find someone in education whose theology was well thought through, and also that it would be similar to mine in a Bible-based way. So I looked overseas, but for me, I felt the best one was Murdoch University, where Dr. Brian Hill was professor. So I went there, and in the first week that I was living in Western Australia, Gavin rang me up 4 times, and we knew each other very well even to start with. His boys all called me auntie, and it was easy for our relationship to develop then.
How many boys did you inherit?
Three.
Three?
Yes.
Boys?
Yes.
Were they at home?
Only one of them was home when we got married. Yeah, one of them was in Perth, and the other one was still in Adelaide.
Okay. Sometimes those relationships where you go into a family can become very complicated. Did you learn anything about how to walk into a family and be the surrogate mother?
Well, two of Gavin's boys were adopted, and I felt like I was the third adoptee in the family. But before he took me out, he said to the boys, "What do you think if I take Auntie Sylvia out?" And I got the thumbs up from them all, so that helped.
So you must have done some good pro work beforehand to lay the field. Yes. That's good.
Yeah.
You wrote a book. If you go to Google and Google in Sylvia Collinson, your name comes up a lot on Google. And you wrote a book called Making Disciples. It's interesting in the story of Jesus how he built community. He built a small community of Peter, James, and John as his inner group, then the 12 disciples, then the group who followed him. When Paul created, when he went out in his mission work, Paul didn't just make believers. What he did was he made sure they formed into communities, which became churches and followers of Jesus together. In your book, you talk about the fact that discipleship is not just learning facts, but it comes out of relationships and community. Do you want to explain that?
Yeah. This was something I thought. We tell people that, you know, Jesus's great command is to go in and make disciples of all nations. And I thought, we don't have any courses at colleges that are disciple making. We have evangelism, we have preaching, we have counseling, everything else, but nothing on disciple making. So I thought, I'm going to have a look at the New Testament and see what the processes were that Jesus did. How did he make disciples? Because if he was making disciples, then and telling his disciples to make disciples, they must have known what he meant. So I read through the Gospels. I started and read Matthew's Gospel for about a term and came up with some things. And I went to Mark then and did that for a term, and then Luke for a term, and just processed through it all. And I found that so many of the books that were written on discipleship say, here's some Bible studies that you can do one-to-one with somebody else, and that'll make them a disciple. And I'd always felt uncomfortable with that because I think it's a power-weakness relationship, which isn't healthy. Mm. And I know of situations where it's been particularly unhelpful to have had that one-on-one strong power-weakness relationship.
Yeah. Our faith is not just taught, it's caught as we rub shoulders in the reality of life with other fellow believers in Jesus.
Yeah. So, you know, I looked at how Jesus chose 12. I discovered that there's most of the lists of the 12's names list them with an and into there. So they're in partners, and it's Peter and Andrew, James and John, Philip and Bartholomew, Matthew and Thomas. And I thought, now that's interesting, because not only are they in a group, but they are also in pairs. And Jesus often used the pairs to do particular jobs for him and sent them out on mission, and then brought them back to reflect on their experiences. So it was a whole of life experience that what Jesus did. And that's why for me it's so important that young believers are part of a community.
Yeah. And it's relationships.
Yes, because what you learn from living with people and being with people is a very powerful means of learning. And because I've been single, I've lived with a lot of different people.
Was it always easy?
No, there were a few very difficult situations, but you learn out of them too.
Sometimes the hardest things are the things we learn the most from.
They are. Yeah. And I think if I reflect back on my life, the most difficult times are the times when I've been closest to God, when I've been totally dependent on him, and when he's been teaching me about himself and me.
And you had a difficult time some years ago with the passing of Gavin.
Yes. Because I was married late, we were hoping for 25 years. After 10, he'd had some illness previous to that and had developed a very rare blood disease, and we knew that that could turn at any stage into leukemia. And then around our 10th wedding anniversary, that happened. And so there were 7 months in which he was mostly at home. I was mostly caring for him 24 hours a day. And that was the horriblest time of my life. So I can think of Gavin brought me the greatest joy in my life, but also that was the most difficult.
So God doesn't call us to whitewash our difficult experiences. Some things are just plain hard and difficult. And challenging. So what difference did your faith make to you in that journey of great difficulty?
Every day I'd wake up and say, God, I just need enough strength to go through today, not knowing what the day would hold. I used to keep a bag packed for us to rush off to the hospital in a hurry. I remember being in Sydney. I was at Morling College teaching when Gavin rang and said that was when he had the diagnosis of leukemia. And I remember driving home and thinking, you know, what's all this? And it was a day-by-day experience, but God was there, and I felt he was my rock, he was my shield, he was my shelter. And it was a precious time with Gavin. As well as that, we had because Gavin had been a part of a school community, where at that stage we'd just been in ministry together at Gosford in a church community. I had friends and ex-students all over the place. So when I was really in need of prayer, I would send off an email to maybe 100 different people and
so
feel
you
very
wrote
supported.
About this book about discipling and the need for community, but it doesn't it's not just theory, because you discovered in that process that community is actually so essential for us in all that we go through, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't think I would have coped at all without without that.
So having written a book about the need for community.
And being vulnerable and allowing other people in the community to minister to me.
That's interesting. You saw your father's tears, what that meant for you. Many years later on, you are willing to be vulnerable yourself. It's interesting how things come back on themselves.
They do,
Okay, so Gavin passed away. My relationship with you is we've been involved in various things together, and my perception is that you haven't let it stop you. You're still rolling. You've been involved in teaching English to migrants and refugees. You're involved still in theological education, Morling College and other ways, and various groups and committees. So we come to Easter Sunday, and it's the Resurrection Sunday. It's a Sunday with a difference this year because we have the coronavirus. People are caught inside. We're not allowed to go and celebrate the way we normally do. Let me just read from John chapter 20, just a few verses. Early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. And so we read on then how she goes back and tells the disciples, Peter and John, run to the tomb. They race each other. And they go in and they see that the tomb is empty. Then we read from verse 10, then the disciples went back to their home, but Mary stood outside the tomb crying, and she meets two angels. At this she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, but she did not realize that it was Jesus. Woman, he said, why are you crying? Who is it you are looking for? And thinking he was the gardener, she said, sir, if you'd carried him away, tell me where you've put him, and I will get him. One determined woman. Jesus said to her, Mary. And she turned toward him and cried out in Aramaic, Rabboni, which means teacher. And then she went and told the disciples that Jesus had risen. So this Mary from Magdala is the first person to meet the risen Jesus. She's a woman. Jane and I were fortunate enough last year to take a group to Magdala, And today Magdala is a city that has just been discovered in the last few years. And there's an it's a live archaeological site, an extensive city. They've only uncovered a little bit of it. And there's also there this wonderful worship center, beautiful art, and it's dedicated to the women of the Bible, of which Mary Magdalene is one. So as someone who is involved as a woman in ministry, what does it mean for you to read your Bible and understand that God chose a woman whose testimony at the time was often considered suspect as a woman? How do you feel that the fact that God chose a woman to be the first person to meet the risen Jesus and to testify about that?
I think God's idea of women is not quite the same as the world's idea. And I have experienced so many times that God values women, not because they're able to be in competition with men, but because they have a unique contribution. And I think it's amazing that the most exciting, amazing news ever to come to the world with the resurrection of Jesus was given to a woman to then go and tell the other disciples. And that's always given me confidence. I guess I grew up where women were thought a bit inferior. My brother used to say, oh, you know, shut up, you're a woman. But
little did he know.
So to me, the value that God placed on that message and entrusting it to Mary Magdalene gave her status. One of the church fathers calls Mary Magdalene the apostle to the apostles. And so she went and passed that message on to the other disciples. And to me, that's great. I'm glad he did. Yeah.
And us males even have a bit to answer for in the heritage of Mary. There is a pope in the 6th century who gave a famous sermon where he confused Mary Magdalene with the woman who was the sinner who anointed Jesus' feet. And ever since then, Mary Magdalene was known as the sinful woman. But it's wrong. She's not. She's just someone who just deeply loved Jesus proactively and who Jesus just honoured so greatly.
Yeah, it's interesting. In the lists of disciples, there's the male lists always start with Peter, but the female lists, if the mother of Jesus is there, then her name comes first and then Mary Magdalene's. But if the mother of Jesus isn't there, then Mary Magdalene's name always comes first. And it's considered that she was the one who was in leadership of the women, whereas Peter was in leadership of the men.
The apostle to the apostles.
Yes.
You've been thinking a little bit about Easter Sunday and just the wonderful news that Jesus is alive. And you just had some thoughts about that. Do you want to just share them with us?
Yeah. Just the importance of the resurrection. I think it was, I just love Resurrection Sunday because it's a day of great joy because Jesus died, but he came alive again. And the fact of him being resurrected really means that he was not just a good man, he was not just a teacher, but he was God. And something which I read very early in my young youth was a book by a lawyer called Who Moved the Stone? And this lawyer went through all the possible people that might have moved the stone away from the tomb and then let Jesus sort of out. And he considered whether it was Jesus himself, but then because he had been beaten and crucified, nails through his hands and feet, no way would he have been able to move the stone. He looked at the soldiers who were there guarding the tomb, and why would they have wanted to move the stone? They had no motive. They were Romans. They weren't involved in this. He looked at the Jewish leaders. Did they want to somehow or other get people to believe that this man who'd been crucified had come alive again. Well, that would have gone against every one of their reasons for actually crucifying him in the first place. So, and then he looked at the disciples. Did they move the stone? And none of their response to Jesus' crucifixion was one of fear and not believing that this in any way would lead to anything else. They just saw it as his death. And so the fact that in God's power the stone was moved, Jesus was resurrected, it actually proves that he was the person he said he was. Three times before he died, he told his disciples that he was going to die, that it would be at the hands of those who were against him, but he promised that he would rise again. So to me, it's just wonderful to have the assurance that, yes, this man, this God-man, really was who he said he was. And he rose again and now is alive forever. Another reason I think the resurrection is so important, Christians believe that we can be forgiven because of Jesus dying on the cross for us, and he took our punishment. But the resurrection actually proves that he did it. He's not just a man saying, you know, I'm taking your sins or anything else and just dying. But it proved that we can have forgiveness in him. And it's something which Christians have a capacity for, which many times astounds the world, and that's Christians' capacity to forgive. And I'm reminded of the Abdullah family just recently who lost three of their children to a drunk driver in Oatlands. And
their response was amazing.
It was, yes. It was, they described it as unimaginable tragedy and unfathomable beyond all description. And yet, at the same time, they were able to say that they forgave that man. Now, I was listening to a program on the ABC just a matter of days after that, and for half an hour there was a phone in when the radio announcer couldn't believe that anybody who had suffered such terrible loss would ever be able to forgive. And various people rang in and said no, they wouldn't be able to forgive. But there were some who rang and said they were Christians, and because they knew the forgiveness of God, they could then forgive others. And it's our being forgiven and knowing that God has done that for us, no matter how dreadful the things we've done, is that then enables us to be able to have that forgiveness for others.
The great mark of Christianity, as compared to many other faiths, is the absolute central place of forgiveness.
That's right. Yes, yes. And forgiveness is never easy. You know, sometimes when I was a teacher, some kid would do something to another kid and say, oh, I'm sorry. And I'd think, no, you're not sorry. And the other kid wouldn't forgive them, you know, they'd done something to them. I think it's a godlike quality that God gives the capacity to people to be able to forgive the most atrocious things. Some people who perhaps don't know him personally sometimes have, I think, a little bit of God in them that allows them to forgive. But I think it's something that Christians find they are able to do in God's strength, not in their own.
And sometimes it's not easy.
No, exactly. Yeah, yeah. The third thing about the resurrection is that Jesus' resurrection guarantees that for those of us who believe in Jesus, that we'll also be raised to a new life, and that new life will be with him forever. And as I think about losing my husband, but also parents and close friends who have been very much a part of my life, knowing that that isn't the end, that there is life beyond the grave. I remember one time, Gavin and I spent a lot of time in doctor's surgeries, and I would sit down in the waiting room while he went in and had whatever he needed doing or whatever. And sometime after he passed away, I had this thought of me sitting in a waiting room, and Gavin had gone through to this fantastic place where he was at peace, where there was no more pain, no more suffering. And I got quite angry with him. I thought to myself, how dare he go and leave me here, and he's gone to that better place.
And even better than Boambi.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah, and I think that's a hope that sustains me through particularly as difficulties in life, that there is more to this world than this life. There's more to us as beings who God created to have an eternal existence with him. And I think that's why coronavirus, with all of its tragedies, is a time for us all to re-examine our own place on this world. And it's not all that there is, and to see that we are confident in our relationship with God and believing in him.
So on this Easter Sunday, when our world is in a strange place, so many of us are confined to home and not being able to go and do the things we normally do, and yet we can still rejoice and give thanks to God that Jesus is risen. The new life, the hope on this life now and future is because of him, and we can give thanks and praise God.
That's right.
Sylvia, thank you very much for joining us today. If people would like to know more about this Jesus who rose again, how can they contact you?
Well, perhaps if they contact Rick, and Rick can give you my details.
So if they contact the church, office at rhbc.com.au, and we can get in touch with you.
That sounds lovely.
Sylvia, thank you very much. And God bless you for Easter Sunday.
And happy Easter to all those who are listening to
Thank you.
Thank you.
For any information about the church and what's happening and how we're arranging things during this significant time of the virus shutdown, the best place to contact us would be at office@rhbc.com.au. If you have any special prayer points or things you'd like to let us know about, please let us know, and we'd love to respond in any way we possibly can. Also, in terms of offerings, if you'd like to give direct debit, if you'd like to contact us at the office on that email address, we'll provide the information of how to do direct debit offering. We'd just like to say that our prayers are with you and in every way during this significant time. And if there's any way we can help and reach out in care and love for the community and those around us, we would love to do so in whatever way we can. So please contact us. God bless everybody.